Welcome, all you liars, infidels, and fools. My name is Haley.
And my name's Brandy. And we are Easy Killer.
Easy Killer.
Easy Killer.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Easy Killer. It's Brandy.
And it's Haley.
Yeah, we're very fucking robotic today, you guys. Today, we are talking about domestic violence. And it's not nothing to laugh about, but Haley's going to tell us a story about Dominique Dunn.
Yeah, Dominique Dunn. So, if you're thinking I'm talking about the true crime correspondent Dominique Dunn, you would be correct. I'm not talking about him, I'm talking about his daughter. But Yeah, I'm sure everybody's heard of him. You used to watch the TV show back in the day, didn't you?
Right. Yeah. Dominique. What was it called?
Hold
it's on. Something. We're gonna have to know it.
It's in my notes, but it's like way far down. Dominique Dunn's Power, Privilege, and Justice.
Hmm.
It was on Court TV. I remember I used to watch Court TV all the time.
Me too. What episode? What? I'm trying to remember which one I used to watch. There was a Court TV episode I watched back when it happened, and I thought, wow, this is intriguing. And that's how I knew I loved true crime.
Mm-hmm. If you've loved true crime from the beginning, you remember Court TV.
Yeah, and it's like, it's all come full circle because you have Unsolved Mysteries, America's Most Wanted. You'd be the creepy one watching all the missing people, and then you'd be thinking about how it's going to be solved. Well, yeah, I did.
Solved, aka Morgan Nick, last episode.
Right. Last episode was put a little bit of a damper on us, but it's something that happened, so.
Right.
Let's get this motherfucker going, because it is a doozy. I do want to put a warning out that this does involve domestic violence, and if you are sensitive to that, you may want to turn off or go and do something else besides listen to us, because I'm telling you.
It's springtime. People need to get their yard work in, so.
Hell yeah, because don't listen to us if this is going to offend you. Right. But we are going to have some information at the end of the episode about domestic violence, and we'll get on with the story now. So tell me more about Dominique Dunn, Haley.
This is an episode about Miss Justice, as well as a Hollywood murder, if you will.
Right.
There's a lot of, there's a dark side of Hollywood, as everyone knows, I think. We're going to dig into one of the darkest Hollywood murders. Dominique Ellen Dunn was born on November 23rd, 1959. Her father, as we talked about him earlier, was Dominique Dunn. And at the time, he was a TV and film producer. He was also an author. And her mother was Ellen Griffin Dunn, who her friends called her Lenny.
Yeah, that's what I was saying, Lenny.
Lenny from Ellen, but okay. She was an actress and a ranch heiress. So she was the heiress to a ranch.
Hell yeah.
Sounds pretty majestic, if you ask me. I'd like to own a ranch, maybe. If I had enough money to pay people to take care of it. Ellen attended Miss Porter School, and if that rings a bell to you, it was from the Cheshire episode.
The
daughter Haley Pettit, she went to Miss Porter School as well. I like making connections. They were very privileged people, both of them.
Right, very. They had a lot of money.
Yeah. A lot of money, a lot of notoriety, you know, and
they were in a social different class, as you would say.
Yeah. So they got married in 1954. Together, they had 5 children total. 2 of their daughters died in infancy. So the surviving children that they had were Griffin, who was named after his mother's maiden name, Alexander, and Dominique, who was obviously named after her father, Dominic. Griffin Dunn was also an actor, and he was in An American Werewolf in London.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that.
I don't know what role he played. I guess I should have looked that up, but whatever.
Right.
So, her mother and father divorced in 1965 when Dominique was only 6 years old. And she lived with her mother, but remained very close with her father. And her godparents were Maria Cooper Janis, who is the daughter of actor Gary Cooper and film producer Martin Manulis. And
I was like, I was going to say, that's a funny name, that last name.
Martin Manulis.
Manulis. Medulla la bagada. That's what her mind.
I don't even know if I'm saying that right, honestly.
I like it. I wonder if that's going to be in the video, because that was kind
of... Oh, and also, I wanted to say, there seems to be a coincidence. There is like another podcast, you know, in the podcast world. Yeah, we're not going to say who, but, you know, they're a bigger name podcast. And they seem to like be like listening to our thoughts or something, because every time we're about to release like an episode, they release it on like the day before we're getting ready to record it. So, but it's okay.
Yeah. It's not we're like they're copying it.
No, but I wanted to make it clear that we weren't copying them, you know?
Yeah. We're like minds. That's good. We're like minds. I love the podcast world, because the podcast world can have so many different of the same thing, and it's still going to be different.
That's true, yeah, because every person is different, and every podcast will bring a different point of view.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. So, yeah.
There's room for all of us. I just wanted to make it clear that we weren't trying to, play off of what they were releasing and then release the same episode, because that's really not what we're trying to do here. Dominique obviously grew up very wealthy and privileged,
right,
as we said earlier, and she spent a year after her high school graduation in Florence, Italy, where she learned to speak Italian.
Damn.
But she ended up coming back to Hollywood after a year in Italy when her mother was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
That's sad. Ain't that MS?
Also, yeah, MS, which is also what the mother from the Cheshire episode had.
There's a lot of coincidences in this.
I know, right?
That is so crazy. Damn, did everybody's mom have multiple sclerosis in there?
Maybe.
I called it motor sclerosis.
Dominique grew up around, you know, the stars, Hollywood, things like that. So it's only normal that she would want to become an actress as well. Her first role was the 1979 TV movie Diary of a Teenage Hitchhiker, where she played a teenager who was, you guessed it, a hitchhiker.
Right.
And the teenager survives a brutal rape and beating.
Damn.
Yeah. It was a very, very serious role. And that's kind of the type of roles that Dominique tended to gravitate towards, because she was a very good, like, serious actress. And I'm not saying that, like, people who do comedy aren't serious or...
Right.
But I'm just saying, like, she was an emotional type of actress. She did very well in emotional and serious roles. So, she had a lot of emotion. And she was beautiful. She was like one of those like, she's pretty, but she's not pretty like by society's standards. I mean, I'm not saying society standards, but like,
I know what you say.
Like, she's pretty, but in like a natural and very unique way.
Right. Yeah.
She's got like these, like her eyes. I couldn't take my eyes off her eyes every time, every photo I saw of her. She just like has these beautiful eyes, and she was just a beautiful, beautiful girl. And she was, you know, just starting out in Hollywood, and she had a lot of small supporting roles in a lot of 1980s TV series, such as Lou Grant, which I've never heard of, Family, which I've never heard of, Heart to Heart, which I've also never heard of, and Fame, which I have heard of.
She looks like her dad.
Yeah.
You know?
If you see her mom, she looks a lot like her mom, too. She gets, like, the eyes.
Oh, and yeah.
The eyes and the nose from her mom, I think.
She definitely does look like her brother, and I've seen him in multiple movies, and mm-hmm. I liked him as an actor.
Yeah. And she also starred along Sam Elliott and Tom Selleck in the 1982 TV film The Shadow Riders.
Hmm.
So she, you know,
the 80s were great.
Sam Elliott was big. Tom Selleck was big.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, she was rubbing elbows with a lot of famous people.
She would have probably been a great actor, you know. She probably would have went on to do great things.
Oh, definitely. And what's so sad is she was taken away right in the height of her career.
It's just sad.
Yeah, so her breakout film role was the 1982 film Poltergeist.
Yeah. I can't even look at a static TV now.
towards the end of this episode, I'm going to touch lightly on the Poltergeist curse.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but
oh yeah, I have.
Yeah, I'm going to just quickly go over what it is and the different oddities and untimely deaths and things of that nature, close calls, you know. There's a lot, really. I mean, it's kind of crazy, honestly. And a lot of people say that her death was linked to this movie that put a curse on pretty much all the people that were involved in it.
Right.
But we'll get more into that later. So we're going to talk more about Dominique now. So
right.
In Poltergeist, she played Dana Freeling, who was the teenage daughter of a couple whose family is haunted by ghosts and poltergeists and whatnot. I don't even know.
Right.
I should say ghosts and
goblins.
I don't know what the difference is. But her co-star, Zelda Rubinstein, who, you know who I'm talking about, right? The little tiny chick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Voice. She was in Teen Witch, and she played Madame Serena.
Oh, you know, yeah, I remember.
Teen Witch, don't you?
Yeah, I love Teen Witch.
I love Teen Witch. It's my favorite movie. Anyway, so Zelda Rubinstein said that Dominique Dunn was way more advanced than her role in Poltergeist, and that her role was very underdeveloped from what Dominique was used to. So when I say that, I mean, right. Like, you know how I talked earlier about how she was like a very serious actor.
Yeah.
Yeah, she just kind of played right. Like a teenage airhead. Her character right. Had no depth, really. And she was
right.
Really good at roles like that. So she
dramatic
felt like,
roles.
Yeah, she felt like she was more advanced than her role. But that was her breakout role because it was her first feature film that she
right.
Made. So in 1981, Dominique and her friends decided that they wanted to throw a party to meet boys.
That's how it always ends.
Right. Her friend, Gloria Gifford, who is also an actress, she wasn't like a really big time actress. I think her biggest film she was in, she played a nurse in Halloween 2.
Oh,
so,
I love Halloween 2.
Yeah, so she wasn't like, you know, a big actress, but she was in a few bigger films. So
right, cult classics.
She had invited a friend of hers to this party, and he brought a man named John Sweeney with him. And immediately Gloria said that she didn't like him, but he had started to strike up a conversation with Dominique. So they quickly started, you know, dating, and they got, you know, super involved in, they moved really fast pretty much, because within a few weeks he was moving in with her in her West Hollywood home.
Let me pause you there. That's what happens typically in a domestic violence situation. They kind of love bomb you, like where they get really, it's really intense. It's really crazy. It's really like, oh my God, I'm in love. And then before you know it, you're living with them. So
Yeah. It's
a pattern.
And
definitely kind of a pattern.
Backing off what you said is that he he was very, like, his coworker said that he, like, shut off everything in his life and only focused on Dominique and their relationship.
Oh, my God.
So, it was more of, like, an obsession rather than...
It was a red flag.
Being in love.
Big one.
Yeah. Right. So, quickly, as these things turn quickly, their relationship became strained because of John Sweeney's jealousy and possessiveness of Dominique. And,
which ain't shocking.
Right. And they had like a textbook toxic relationship or abusive relationship, really.
Right.
Fighting all hours of the night and it, you know, eventually turning physical afterwards. And another red flag is because I used to be friends with this girl who was severely abused by her boyfriend, and she would tell me when our relationship is good, it's really good. It's like great.
It is
the best. And but then when it's bad, it's
the,
like,
worst in the world.
The worst you could imagine. And I, like, that stuck with me. And that's exactly what Dominique's friends said about their relationship. That when it was good, it was best. When it was bad, it was the worst. And I just always feel like that. And, like, women, if you're out here listening, I mean men too, if you're out here listening to this and, you know, that describes your relationship, then you should probably take a second guess as to whether or not you should continue relationship with that person, because that's not normal.
It is not. And also, I'm going to piggyback off you that if you are in a relationship and it's been just a couple weeks or maybe a week and he's already like, I love you, you're the best, you're the greatest. I mean, just it's too much at once. Most women that have been abused or had a traumatic childhood or something, that seems welcoming to them because they're like, oh, my God, he really loves me. But they are a wolf in sheep's clothing. They're not doing that because they love you. They had this feeling to control you, and that's how they get you, is by love bombing you in the beginning. Bombing you with so much love, you don't see that they're isolating you and getting you closer to them, only them. Your whole existence is them, and same for, you know, them. They just want to control you. And basically, that's what happened with Dominique. He was in a stage where now the love bombing's done faded away, and now the real him is showing. And it's controlling, it's jealousy, it's telling her who she can be with, who she can't be with. It starts small, and that's why they don't see it, and then it goes, and it's something huge. And then you have people that just show that shit up front.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I think a lot of her friends noticed this before she did.
Your friends always do. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because I've been the friend in that situation a few times actually, and it's not a fun position to be in whatsoever. It's awful, actually. I lost one of my really good friends because of a domestic violence situation, but thankfully she was able to get out of it, and now we are friends again. So. And,
that's,
you know,
great.
Her life is great, and she's, you know, doing her thing. And so
it's hard.
There can be a happy ending.
Yeah. And it's hard because they, you know, when a person's in a, like, abusive relationship, they believe everything the other person's telling them. So if the other person is telling them, like, don't talk to that friend, they don't really like you. They don't want to be around you. Look how they treat you. They really, it really messes with your mind and makes you think, well, really, they don't like me. What if they, you know, what if they are using me? Or what if that's just slowly to isolate you from everybody? They shut off your friends first because your friends are the ones that are like, girl, something's wrong with him. Please, ladies, if your friends are telling you and you know that they are not capping, they're telling the fucking truth, and they're like, hey, there's something wrong with him. Like, he's couch hopping and he just wants somewhere to stay. Or he's love bombing you with a bunch of shit. You need to get the fuck out. Listen to them. They're telling you the truth. I know some people have hating ass girlfriends that just don't want their friends in a relationship. We get that. But no. Yeah, this is way more serious than that.
A friend of yours that you respect enough to think, you know, to know that they want the best for you, then if it's that type of friend, or if it's the type of friend that's just like, there every now and then and not really, you know, that much depth to the relationship, you should listen. If not, I mean, listen, but at least, you know, take into consideration what they have to say.
Because what they do is they isolate you. They get you away from everybody and basically train you. That's what it is.
Yeah.
They're trying to train you. Yeah.
Exactly, this is exactly what John Sweeney did to Dominique. He isolated her from all of her friends.
Yeah.
And, but she was swept off her feet because he was so into her and focused on her that she was like, oh, this
feels good.
So in love with me. And, you know, her friends would say that Dominique and Sweeney would often dress in the same color. And they said that this was kind of like a way that he would show his possession over her. And, you know, like they would wear like all white. Both of them would wear all white, and it would be like a, we're together, you know, we're a package deal.
He's fucking weird.
Yeah.
That's weird. And that's some weird ass shit. Here, come here. You're going to match me. We're going to wear jumpsuits.
Right. So Dominique's dad, Dominic, that's kind of hard to say.
Yeah.
He lived on the East Coast. He lived in New York City in Manhattan. And once on Dominique took John Sweeney to Manhattan to meet her father. And they were eating at a restaurant, and a male fan of Dominique's came up to her and asked for her autograph. And John Sweeney like lost his fucking mind and picked him up by his collar and like started shaking him.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Right, and there, like, I'd have been like, sorry, Dad. Can you imagine?
Autograph.
Like, bro, I just wanted you to meet my dad. You're over here choking this fucking waiter guy. Like, the fuck?
Imagine what her dad thought.
Wow, this guy's really possessed with my daughter. That's wild.
Yeah. And he also had a problem with alcohol. And he would get sent into violent rages while he was drunk.
Oh, yeah. Narcotics and alcohol always make the abuse so much worse than what it is. Mm-hmm. Nine times out of 10, he was probably high or drunk when he, you know, when at the end of this.
Yeah. And just a little bit of background on John Sweeney. He was 26 years old, and he grew up in poverty as the oldest of six children in Pennsylvania. And his father was an alcoholic, and his father would beat his mother, and John would try to intervene, which made his father beat him instead of beating
him.
Yeah.
Cycle of abuse.
Yeah, basically. And his friends described him as high energy, creative, aggressive, and short-tempered. He took karate and self-defense classes, so he knew what he was doing as far as.
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't even know how to put that into words.
Right. He was dangerous. He was trying to protect. He was trying to be a fighter.
Right.
He basically, where he grew up, he had to be a fighter. It's a cycle of abuse. He watched his dad beat his mom, so he thought that shit was normal.
Yeah.
And most times, and what's crazy is, and I don't know if you know this, but, you know, beating your wife was legal up until 1920. You was allowed to just fuck your wife up for no reason and hit women. Wow. Like, just beat the shit out of them, and nobody did nothing. But then in 1920, they went ahead and, you know, made it illegal. But it really didn't start kicking off until 1970 when the feminist movement hit. Yeah, that's when in 1970 it started being more noticeable and crazy, you know, getting out there and,
right,
you know, letting everybody know what was going on. Because just because you can't see the bruises does not mean that it's not abuse. You know what I'm saying? So a lot of people hid that shit.
Yeah.
Just like Dominique did.
Yeah. So Sweeney was also a painter, and his idol was Salvador Dali. And Salvador Dali had been, or he had done a painting in blood one time. And so Sweeney had done the same thing and basically did like a painting in blood. And I don't know whose blood it was. If it was his own, I have no idea. I just know that he did that. A little weird.
That is weird. Have you ever seen them women do it with period blood? That's some shit you don't want to see. I never got that.
I've also seen the one where the woman puts... Oh my God, this is so disgusting.
Don't tell me that.
She puts the... like yarn or like whatever you would like knit with in her while she's on her period, and then she like knits like a
sweater with her vagina. She knits a sweater with her vagina.
She doesn't knit it with her vagina. Okay, she pulls the yarn.
That's a powerful vagina.
She pulls the yarn out of her vagina while she's on her period, so there's blood on the yarn, and as she's like pulling it out, she's using that yarn to knit with her hands.
This smells like a lot of pennies. You know how blood smells irony? Why do I feel like her studio smells like iron, like pennies?
I don't want to talk about it anymore. I'm getting really uncomfortable.
Oh God, no! Who does that? Just like
feminist.
Hey, you know what?
Feminist.
I'm gonna stick a whole ball of yarn in my puss, and I'm gonna pull it out, and I'm gonna make you the most magnificent thing ever. No, it's strange. We don't want to see your period blood. Keep that shit together. Ugh. Yes, we're proud we got periods, but I don't want to fucking know about your period. Like you don't want to know about mine.
I'm not necessarily proud now. I'm not gonna say I'm proud.
I fucking hate being on my period.
I hate it too. It's the worst.
Like, what is it for? If you're not making kids, goodbye. You know?
Yeah, misdirecting me. They're like, if you're not making a kid, we're gonna fucking torture the fuck out of you.
Right. You're just gonna let you bleed once a month, and you're gonna have to deal with it, even though you're not using your vagina for anything else. And fucking John Sweeney over there trying to paint and stalk fucking Dominique Dunn. God. Creepy ass. Look, wear the same color as me. You're like, get the fuck out of here, guy.
Right. Bye. So John Sweeney moved to Los Angeles in 1976, and he got a job as the sous chef at a restaurant, an upscale Hollywood restaurant, I might add. Ma Maison.
Yeah.
And
that's probably how he pulled the bitches.
Oh, yeah.
Was it Dominique Dunn? Is that the dad? Dominique Dunn said that he women, they didn't even notice it because women was always around him and nobody knew. They said they did not know about none of it until after the fact. That's how deceiving he was. Except for that blow up in there. But he said he had never seen nothing else, so he'd never really faced it. Right. He didn't really think about it.
It's crazy. Yeah, and so at this Ma Maison that he was a sous chef at, Wolfgang Puck was the head chef at the time.
Right. Oh, Wolfgang Puck. I remember that name.
He's famous. So John actually took over for Wolfgang Puck as executive chef in 1981 when Wolfgang Puck, you know, went on to do whatever else he did. Which was a lot.
Fucking Wolfgang.
But this podcast is not about Wolfgang Puck, so.
this podcast is sponsored by Wolfgang Puck.
If you want to know more,
fuck you.
Google him.
Oh my God.
So in August of 1982 was when Sweeney and Dominique's relationship kind of started to turn physical a lot. Right. They had gotten into an argument and Sweeney had yanked out handfuls of her hair. So after he did that, she left and stayed at her mother's, and Sweeney followed her there and he began banging on the windows and the doors, demanding to be let in. And Lenny, her mother, called the police
and or she didn't call the police. She threatened to call the police if he did not leave. So he ended up leaving, and everything, you know, was okay for that night. So about a week after this happened, Dominique returned home, and she continued her relationship with Sweeney. And they remained together until 82, when they got into yet another argument, and Sweeney had grabbed her by the throat and threw her on the floor and like strangled her. Because there was a friend staying there with them at the time, and he had heard loud gagging sounds and her screaming for help. So he ran into her into their room, and she said that Sweeney had tried to kill her, and Sweeney had denied it. And he was like, you know, quit being dramatic, come to bed, whatever. So then I think the friend went back out, and then they had gotten into it again. And I think that's when he hit her. And then she had went to the bathroom after that, and she crawled out the bathroom window, and she got in her car, and she, as soon as he heard her engine start, he ran outside and he jumped on the hood of her car. And so she was like, he was on the hood of her car and she was driving.
Right.
So she stopped, like came to a sudden stop, and that knocked him off the hood. And then she finally was able to drive away. So she had went and stayed with a friend of hers, and her friend took photos of her, you know, bruising, and the she had marks on her neck from being strangled. So the next day she filmed an episode of a TV show called Hill Street Blues, where she played a teenage mother who was a victim of child abuse. And she ends up giving her baby up for adoption, fearing that she'll repeat the cycle of abuse. And she had visible bruises, to which she didn't have to have any makeup done to appear that she had been abused. And all these marks and bruises were from what Sweeney had did to her the night before.
Right. Fucking sad. And you can Google that picture, and it's fucking awful.
Yeah, we'll post it on our Instagram page. But yeah. And what I never really understood was like, why was ever like the director, the producer of the TV show, why were they just like, okay, cool, like shoot, you know, like I just that doesn't make any sense. But why? I mean maybe they did, I don't know. Maybe she said everything was fine. I don't know. But it just seems weird to me that like a woman would be able to come in with bruises all over her
and nobody says not nothing.
Require any makeup. Yeah, nobody says anything. Like, I feel like that would be like in today's, like if that happened today, that episode would have never been filmed.
Right. They would have been like, no.
She wouldn't have even been in the role, honestly. I think if this happened today, I don't think that would have ever happened. That's what's weird. That's what's crazy about it. That they were just like, okay, cool. Like,
let's get this fucking thing rolling.
It's sad. Because I watched the episode of that show, and she was great in it, obviously. She was a great actress, but it was just so sad that, like,
this looked really bad, yeah.
That was actually real, and that actually, yeah, and it's just, it makes it, like, surreal almost.
It's very depressing, you know what I'm saying? Because you're like, fuck, man. Damn.
Yeah.
I can't believe this shit. It's sad because it's just abuse. There's nothing. And then you become a battered woman so much that it really is something called battered woman syndrome, which is like PTSD that you develop and you learn helplessness that caused you to believe that you deserve the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you're beat so much that you think, well, maybe I deserve this. Maybe it's me fucking up. Maybe I need to just be better. And me, maybe I need to do something. And you just start really thinking that, like, something's wrong with you. It's just how it goes.
Yeah.
In abusive relationships.
And so after this happened, she had written a letter to Sweeney. And I don't know why. I just feel better calling these murderers by their last name.
Right. Fuck.
I feel like it. You know what I mean? You call them by their first name, it gives them too much of a...
That's true. Of a,
identity to, I don't know. But anyways, so right, she wrote a letter to Sweeney, and the letter said, "I need more time. I think good thoughts about you, but I need to go slowly. I think that if we would just not talk on the telephone for a while, I would only think of the good things. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Given enough time alone, I'll probably beg you to come back, but please let me have that time."
God, she wanted to get away bad.
Yeah. Like, but I think she was scared to like end it completely, you know?
Yeah, she was scared.
So after he had assaulted her, she ended up staying with her friends for the next few days until she finally called him and ended the relationship, and she demanded that he moved out. So he moved out. And
she ain't fucking playing today. She's gotta go, buddy.
She's not.
You reach a realization that I need to get the fuck out, like, right now, because it's not good, and I want to get away. And she's at that point. And it takes the person to get to that point. Nobody can get that person to the point. Begging them is not going to help. Doing all the shit. The only thing you can do is be supportive of them, because they're in mental turmoil. They're in physical, mental, every kind of fucking abuse you can think of. They are going through it. And you just got to be supportive and try to do the best that you can do. Me, myself, I call the police on him every day. Until he was arrested. I would do everything in my power. If I knew my friend was physically being beat, I would beat his ass with a bat. And I know it's not the same as everybody. I think every day there's some emotional abuse in every relationship. Sometimes, some way, somebody is being emotionally abusive. But when you're sitting there beating the fuck out of somebody and it's physically showing, even if it's not, if a man or woman are putting their hands on somebody else, it's fucking abuse and it needs to stop. Keep your fucking hands to yourself. We're in kindergarten, ain't we? Keep your goddamn hands to yourself. That's what they say in school. That's what you need to do.
Yeah.
It's silly.
I agree. So Sweeney finally moved out, and right after he moved out, she had the locks changed and she had moved back into the home that they had once shared together. And while the locks were being changed, Sweeney drove by the house.
Oh, shit.
So she was standing out there with a locksmith, and she saw him driving past the house. So he was still, like, stalking her, basically. Yeah.
He was obsessed, it seems like.
Yeah, and so she had told a friend that she was done with the relationship and that she would never let someone treat her that way ever again.
Oh, man, dude.
Yeah. So on October 30th, Halloween Eve, 1982, Dominique was at her West Hollywood home rehearsing lines for an upcoming miniseries. The miniseries was called V, just V. I don't know what it's about. So she was casted for this miniseries with an actor named David Packer. Mm-hmm. And earlier that day, Sweeney had gotten a chocolate mask mold made for her, and it was modeled after her face, basically.
What the fuck?
Yeah, weird. And he had a coworker of his leave the mask and a case full of hand-carved pumpkins on her doorstep. And she called him at work that day, and she was basically like, "Stop sending me stuff to my door. Our relationship is over, you know, like, it's just stop." Right. And so this obviously, like, sent him into, like, a frenzy. He was freaking out.
He's pissed because he's losing that control.
Right. He calls his therapist, and he tells his therapist that he feels like he's losing it. And
somebody should have locked him up.
He should have been locked up for what he did to her right before that episode of that TV show she filmed. He should have been locked up for that, honestly. But after he talked to his therapist, he hung up with his therapist, and then he started to, like, call her at, like, over and over and over again.
Right. And she's probably like, get the fuck out of here.
She was actually on the phone with a friend of hers, and he had called in and had the operator break into the conversation saying that it was an emergency phone call. And her friend said that she had told her not to take the call, but Dominique was like, "It's okay. He's just really upset. Like, you know, I'll just talk to him and he'll be fine." So
right.
she talks to him and he's like asking if he can come over to her house and talk to her and all this stuff. And she's like, no, you know, don't come to my house.
Appropriate.
So he leaves work and drives. And about 10 minutes later, I'm not going to say drive. I think he might have walked, whatever. He leaves work, and 10 minutes later, he is showing up at her doorstep.
Oh, my God.
And she opened the door, but she kept the little chain lock. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know exactly
like
what you're talking about.
Like, she opened it just like a little bit, but like, the chain lock was still on.
My problem is, like, what is going to, like, what's that little chain going to do? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, like, she ended up unlocking it and agreed to come outside and talk to him. Cause he was just like, please talk to me. Please, please. You know, just being like super
crazy.
Yeah. So they begin to argue, and the actor David Packer recalls hearing, he started hearing like smacking sounds, and then he heard a loud thud. And so he just thought that, which whatever, but he thought that they were just arguing and that she would come back in and everything would be fine. So he actually, like,
if you know that your cast member's getting abused, why didn't he answer the door and help? He's a man.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, where I'm from, men like protect the women.
Yeah.
They go to the door if some crazy ass motherfucking ex is trying to
you know,
kick in the door.
We'll go more into that here in just a second. But so David Packer put on the Poltergeist soundtrack on vinyl to try to drown out the noises so that he could focus on reading a script.
What the fuck?
I know. So outside of the home, outside of the home, Sweeney had begun choking Dominique. And they fell off the porch into the bushes. And then he started choking her. And then he picked her up, like, while he was choking her, lifted her off the ground. And then they fell off into the bushes off the porch. And then he began to drag her while still choking her. He drug her to the next yard over.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I think after he heard that, David, the actor, David Packer, I think after he heard that, he decided that he needed to call 911. So he finally calls 911.
But not go out there and help her.
Right. And
he could have saved her life. I'm sorry, but let me stop for a second.
No,
that motherfucker
fine.
Could have saved her life. Like, there's no wonder why we've never heard his name. Probably her father got him blackballed where he can't even be hired, I bet.
Maybe.
That's some cowardice shit, man.
Yeah.
How do you not go and help somebody you hear being in danger? It's so crazy to me, man.
Yeah.
I've never seen it. It's crazy.
So he called 911, but the police station that he reached said that Dominique's home was out of their jurisdiction. But they also said, which I thought this was kind of funny, they said if he was any type of man, he would go outside himself and help her.
Exactly. Like, go help her. She could have lived.
Yeah.
She could have fucking lived if you would have been a man and went and helped her. How do you turn the music up? Pussy. That guy's a pussy.
So instead of calling the police again or trying to even go out there or do anything, he calls one of his friends and he tells them, if I'm found dead, John Sweeney is my killer. So he's worried about himself, obviously. Because he's like, oh.
Yeah, he's super narcissistic.
Yeah.
But you don't want to protect any? Oh, my God.
So he ran out the back door. And he had approached the front of the home where he saw Sweeney kneeling over Dominique's body. Sweeney looked up at him and he told him to call the police. So even at this point, Sweeney, the one who fucking killed her, is like, hey, dude, call the police. So he runs away. David Packer runs away. And he calls police on a payphone.
And I'm then, about to Google him and see where the fuck he became, because fuck right. David Packer. I'm going to find him on Facebook and flip him off. Like, how the fuck do you do that to a woman? He changed his name. He had to, because you know people was fucking clowning him.
Right.
Is he the one that was, oh, yeah, he was in that show V, You Can't Hurry yeah. Love, mm-hmm. The Running Kid, No Strings Attached in 1997, The Killing Club in 2001. Oh, my God. This guy. Yeah. Well, David Packer, born August 25th, 1962. Fuck you.
That's
you fucking coward.
Right.
And fuck fucking John Sweeney.
Yeah, so finally the police arrived and Sweeney met them in the driveway and he had his hands in the air and he said, I killed my girlfriend and I tried to kill myself.
Oh my God. He's just trying to get into the fucking psychotic ward or whatever.
So Dominique was still alive at this point, but she slipped into a coma.
Man, fuck him. I keep thinking about that guy. I'm going to say that every day on every episode. He could have saved her. And I want y'all to know what I'm talking about. Dominique Dunn could have been saved. If the guy that was fucking rehearsing lines with her would have fucking been a man and jumped up and helped her in any way.
I thought he shot her. There.
Did he shoot her?
No.
Why did I think he shot her?
Because you're thinking of Rebecca Schaefer. That's even worse. You're thinking of Rebecca Schaefer, which I was actually going to do both of them on this episode.
At the same time?
Dominique's ended up being really long, so I was like, you know what? She deserves one episode. So
she sure does. And just Dave, fuck him. Oh, my God. And fuck John Sweeney. I mean, maybe I shouldn't shame that guy because everybody acts different in trauma. But that's you could have saved her. You could have helped in some way. I know people, there's some people that have that can be a hero, and there's some people that won't. I know some people that won't even fuck with it and bounce out because they don't want to get killed. But he didn't have a fucking weapon. He used his goddamn hands.
Right.
His hands. Like, I'm fucking mad right now. Like, how? How does that guy just, oh my God. He's the worst of the worst also. Like, I would feel so guilty the rest of my life.
He's not as bad as John Sweeney, but he was, you know, a little.
He's about up there with me. Maybe just being a coward. You know, he reminds me of Toni Lawrence when she killed Shanda Shear.
Yeah.
She didn't do nothing, but she could have done something to help.
Oh, yeah, for sure. All of them could have fucking done something. Every single one.
But it just gives me Toni Lawrence vibes. You know what I'm saying? Like, sit there and watch the whole thing happen, but do nothing. That's kind of like,
you know what? I don't know this for sure, but I bet you her first name was Tanya.
You want to fuck out all the T's? I swear to God.
Goddamn Tanya.
Oh my God.
Dominique was placed on life support when she arrived at the hospital, but she never regained consciousness. And she had several brain scans done, which showed that she had no brain activity due to oxygen deprivation. Damn. So, just 3 weeks shy of her 23rd birthday, on November 4th, 1982, her parents consented to have her removed from life support.
Fuck, man. That's some deep shit. That's really hard.
Yeah. And to top it all off, her episode that she filmed of Hill Street Blues was aired 2 weeks after her death and was dedicated to her memory, which is kind of almost like fucked up in a way.
Right. We've seen you get beat. We've seen the marks, but we didn't do nothing. So let me just make money off you.
Well, like we said, there's always a dark side of Hollywood, and this is it.
Right. They don't give a fuck. As long as you're making the money, they don't give a fuck.
So.
Hello, Hollywood.
John Sweeney was immediately arrested and charged with attempted murder. But after she died, the charges were dropped and she was charged. She was charged with first degree murder, to which he pleaded not guilty. Okay. So his trial began in August of 1983, and Sweeney took the stand in his own defense.
I bet you he did.
Yep, exactly. So he testified that he had not intended to harm Dominique the night that he had came to her home. He claimed that they had reconciled and were planning on moving back in together and had discussions daily about getting married and having children. And during this testimony, he cried, which tears he don't mean it. Shit, honestly, in a situation like this.
Not to men like him. Men like him don't have emotions or empathy. They don't care. It's all a facade. He's acting.
So on the night of October 30th, Sweeney had said that Dominique had abruptly changed her mind about a reconciliation between them and had told him that she had been lying to him and leading him on about getting back together. And at that point, Sweeney said that he just exploded and lunged towards her. And he claimed to have no recollection of the attack until he discovered that he was on top of Dominique with his hands around her neck. And he choked her for 3 minutes.
3 minutes is a long time to, you know how long it is. And we've said this before. It's very hard to choke somebody manually and kill them.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of strength. And just sitting there for a minute is long as fuck. I can't even concentrate for like 50 seconds, 30 seconds and do the same thing.
Right.
So how the hell you just sit on somebody for 3 minutes and you don't know unless he's clearly mentally deranged and he blacked out. Not blacked out.
No,
but
I don't think he's mentally deranged. I think he's just a woman beater, honestly. I think that's what.
Oh yeah, he got so mad because she's
a fucking woman beater. There's nothing wrong. I mean, obviously, women beaters have something wrong in their brain, obviously, but I don't think it's like a mental illness. You know what I mean? Like that's causing him to do this. Oh, like he's just a fucking piece of shit all around.
Well, think about it like this: he was abused severely when he was a child. So it's a cycle of abuse. He grows the fuck up and does the same thing because that's all he knows. Exactly. And he thinks it's fine to treat people the way he is. I'm telling you, these men are birthed from mothers and fathers who don't give a fuck about them. Y'all want to know how to stop making men like this? How about love your child? How about not to belittle your child? How about to treat your child with some respect and then love them, hug them, touch them, give them, let them have emotions? Because this is what happens when you don't. They turn into men who take their fucking anger and abuse out on innocent people because they was not loved properly as a child. And that's exactly how it leads to now. And that's not an excuse. That's fucking facts.
Yeah.
He wasn't loved enough, hugged enough, treated fairly as a child. And I'm not saying that made him do what he did, but that's what basically breeds men like this. It's all a combination of things. A horrible childhood with your mother or father, you know, not loving you and treating you very badly, belittling you, talking bad about you, embarrassing you. It all leads into shit. Every fucking killer on here has a childhood. What's it lead back to? The fucking mother, the fucking father.
Yeah.
Or neither sometimes. It leads because that's how it happens. They start, we can end this shit as when they're
killed. He said after he discovered he was on top of her with his hands around her neck, that was when he realized that she was not breathing and he attempted to revive her. And the CPR caused her to vomit, which made Sweeney also vomit, and he ran inside and consumed 2 bottles of pills in an attempt to kill himself. The prosecution and the police investigators dismissed Sweeney's version of events as there was no physical evidence that he had consumed any type of pills in an attempt to commit suicide at the time of his arrest. So that was all
just he would have died. A
crock of shit, basically. So he...
Right.
He had returned, he said, after he... had the suicide attempt, he returned to the driveway where Dominique was laying down and he laid down beside her. And then he reached into her mouth and he tried to pull her tongue out of her throat. I guess thinking that was going to do something because his dad was epileptic. And when his dad would have seizures, you know, when you have a seizure, you pull the tongue out of the back of their mouth so they don't like choke on it. And I don't know why he did that thinking that was going to do something. So his attorney,
crazy,
Michael Adelson was his attorney. And he maintained that Sweeney acted out in heat of passion provoked by Dominique's alleged deception of the future of their relationship.
Bitch, who cares? Like, why would you give a fuck? why would you kill somebody because they changed their mind? So you're trying to miss. So the defense attorney's trying to make it seem like it's her fault, trying to basically smear her character so his client can win.
Yeah, basically. So the jury needed to determine whether Dominique's strangulation was out of malice or heat of passion. So Dominique's family disputed the claim that Dominique was even considering reconciling with Sweeney. And upon the arrival of the police on the scene, they found Sweeney to be calm and collected. And the medical examiner who performed Dominique's autopsy determined that she had been strangled for at least 3 minutes, like I said earlier. So, the police and prosecutors tried to dismiss the heat of passion defense, as they believed that given the time that it took to strangle her, he had ample amount of time to regain control of himself, which would have saved her life.
And he didn't.
Basically, yeah. So it was obviously out of malice and not out of heat of passion.
I never understand this. Like, you love them so much, but they're dead. So where does that lead you? Like,
I don't know.
Now you, why don't they think logically? Like, I'm going to kill you and then I'm going to prison for the rest of my life, but you'll be free. Right. I'll be dead.
Right.
Or I'm going to try to attack you, and if I get caught, I'll be in prison. You'll be free. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
No way around it. You can't murder somebody, goddammit, without going to jail. Eventually, you're going to get caught.
So, to establish a history of his violent behavior, the prosecution called one of his ex-girlfriends to testify against him. And his ex-girlfriend's name was Lillian Pierce. And she had testified that her and Sweeney had dated on and off from 1977 to 1980. And she claims that during the relationship, he had assaulted her on 10 occasions. And she was hospitalized. She was hospitalized twice for injuries that he had inflicted on her. During one assault, she had sustained a perforated eardrum, a collapsed lung, and a broken nose.
Yeah.
And they tried to kind of tie his relationship with Lillian kind of to his relationship with Dominique, because Lillian also came from a wealthy family. And they said that Sweeney was so concerned with like his public image, and he wanted to like be someone and be someone important, that he wanted to be with somebody that was from a wealthy, high notoriety family like Dominique's and also Lillian's. So she, once Lillian had cried during her testimony of the abuse, and whenever the prosecutors drew the connection between Lillian and Dominique, Sweeney became enraged and he jumped from his seat and tried to run towards the doors that were leading to the judge's chambers, but he was tackled by the bailiffs and handcuffed to his chair, where he began to cry and apologized for the outburst.
Of course he did. He was just trying to make them think that he can't control himself. That's all he was trying to do.
So we have a dirty judge on our hands.
Oh, in this case. Great.
Which just makes it all that much better. So yeah, right. The judge, Judge Katz with a Z and a K. He ruled the hearing of Lillian's testimony happened while the jury was not present in the courtroom in order for the judge to determine whether or not the testimony was admissible. So after he heard the testimony, after that, he ruled the testimony as irrelevant and prejudicial and granted the request. He ruled the testimony as irrelevant and prejudicial, and the jury never learned of Lillian Pierce's testimony until after the trial. And the judge, Judge Katz, had also refused to allow testimony from Dominique's mother, as well as Dominique's friends, ruling their statements about Sweeney's abusive nature as hearsay.
That's nuts, man, to me. How will she not accept? That's just nuts to me.
So on August 29th, the defense attorney, Michael Adelson, had also requested that Judge Katz rule that evidence was insufficient to try Sweeney on the charge of first-degree murder because there was no evidence of premeditation, whatever. So yeah. The judge, of course, granted the request and instructed jurors that there were only that they were only allowed to consider charges of manslaughter or second-degree murder.
So his attorney tried to argue that he was not a murderer, but a lovesick puppy that was hurt by his girlfriend.
Yeah, and he murdered. But see, you know, with murder, first-degree murder, third-degree murder, if they would have tried him for first-degree murder, he could have got off, and he would have never been charged for it again. So I think they had to at least pick something because they didn't have full proof. Because first-degree murder is murder with malice, meaning that you basically planned it, premeditated it, made it, you know, that was your goal when you went there. When he went there, he knew he was going to kill her. So what the way with they're going with manslaughter is that they're saying he didn't know. He didn't know he was going to kill her. When he got there, his emotion.
Even if he didn't know, it still doesn't make a difference because he still did it. And he still strangled her for 3 minutes.
But it's like, it's like strange. So like, if he would have premeditated and they would have found proof of that, he would have got first-degree murder charges. But because they couldn't find no proof to say, hey, he planned this, but instead, the only thing they could get him that would make it stick was the manslaughter. Because
they could have gotten him on second degree, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they might
have been able to. But it was still a risk.
But a lot of, you know, important testimony was not heard by the jury, so they can only what they hear. So
exactly. On
September 21st, 1983, they deliberated for 8 days and they ended up acquitting him of second degree murder, but found him guilty on the lesser charge voluntary manslaughter.
And he
was also convicted.
Because I want to explain that a little bit because people are like, what's the difference? Involuntary manslaughter means that you were like driving down a road and you got high and you was drunk or something. You hit somebody and you killed them. That would be involuntary. Voluntary means you killed somebody. It wasn't your intent, but you did. You ended up really fucking killing them. So it's kind of like,
but I feel like
kind of like the little shortest of words in the law.
He did have an intent. So,
oh yeah. They just couldn't prove it. He kept it all here. He didn't put it out in writing. Like if he would have,
I feel like they could have proved it had they let the testimonies.
Well, so. I don't know. They could have proved he had domestic violence. Like here I am putting my lawyer thing on, but they could have proved that he was he abused her. That was proof by her testimony. But her testimony only showed his character and what he did in the past. They needed to get for first-degree murder charges. You have to have, like, significant evidence. I'm talking the proof. And,
no,
like,
we're not talking first degree. We're talking second degree.
Second degree.
They already threw out the first degree from being possible. So it was either manslaughter or second degree.
Or second degree. And they threw out second degree because there probably wasn't enough evidence for second degree.
There wasn't enough evidence presented. But the jury's foreman, Paul Spiegel, said that if the jury had heard all of the evidence, because they learned about the evidence after the trial.
Right.
They said if they had heard all the evidence, they would have got him for second degree murder. Yeah. And that's what's the part of it, you know?
That's our justice system in America. Like that the judge has the power to exclude that. I think personally, and this may be stupid or wrong, but I think if it's something to do with that person's character or past, it should be allowed regardless. Regardless if you think it's going to taint the case and taint his image, what the fuck do you think we're there for, ma'am or sir? I've seen that shit with the OJ trial. I've seen it with so many trials where they had really good proof, like physical fucking proof. They would say that it wasn't what it was. You know what I'm saying? So it's frustrating, the justice system.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So he was also convicted of a misdemeanor assault from the altercation that occurred on September 26, 1982. And after he Okay, so Judge Katz had excused the jury, and after he excused them, he had said that justice was served, and Dominic Dunn yelled, "Not for our family." So
right.
Yeah. Before leaving the courtroom, Dominic Dunn accused Judge Katz of purposely withholding Sweeney's ex-girlfriend's testimony from the jury, which would have helped establish his violent history with women.
Exactly. That's right.
And outside of the courtroom, Victims for Victims, which was a victims' rights group that was established by actress Teresa Saldana, who was attacked in a stabbing after her stalker, who was a crazed fan of hers, had posed as Martin Scorsese's assistant and contacted her mother and obtained her address to deliver a script to her. And then he ended up stabbing her, but she ended up surviving it. So she created the Victims for Victims rights group, and they had a protest outside of the courthouse because of the verdict.
Right.
And the prosecutor of this case said that it was the worst trial that he had ever been a part of in his 30 years as a prosecutor.
It's very frustrating.
So, yeah. On November 7th, Sweeney was sentenced to 6 years in prison for manslaughter, which was the maximum sentence that he could receive. And he received an additional 6 months for the assault charge. So he had 6.5 years basically in prison. And at the sentencing, the judge, Judge Katz, flipped like a little bitch and said, and this is a quote, "I'll state on the record." And, let me just mind you, while he was saying this, he was literally like fist down, like beating like the table while he was saying this. He said, "I'll state on the record that I believe this is a murder. I believe that Sweeney is a murderer and not a manslaughterer. This unprovoked killing was one with malice aforethought and therefore is qualitatively more serious than the crime of which he was found guilty by the jury." Isn't that weird though? How like,
so he's trying to blame it on the jury.
He wouldn't let all that information, all that testimony in, but now he's going to flip and be like, Sweeney's a fucking murderer. He did it with malice. All right, then why didn't you let the fucking testimonies show that?
Right. And doesn't the judge have power to stop it or something? Or is that crazy?
Stop what?
Like, I thought that the judge has the power to say, you know what? You're guilty. Go to jail. You know, I mean, thinking that they would.
Not unless they choose to have a bench trial. Which there's no jury.
Yeah, right. And then you just choose the judge instead of the jury.
Yeah.
What would you do? Would you choose a judge, convince one person, or would you convince a jury?
I don't know. I guess it would depend on what I did.
Me too. I think I would go with the jury. I thought about this hard and long. It'd be kind of hard for you to convince one person, but you may be able to reach out to like two or three.
Yeah. So at the sentencing, Sweeney's mother, Mara Sweeney, and two of his sisters tearfully testified that he grew up in a home where his alcoholic father regularly beat his wife. And she said, "John is a victim of violence. Unfortunately, there were no people marching with signs on his behalf when he was the victim."
The fuck's that got to do with the... What the fuck does that got to do with anything?
Not
bitch,
shit.
He already did it. You should have done something. How old are you?
Yeah, and so the jury's foreman that I talked about earlier said that the judge's criticism stemmed not from their verdict, but from the harsh criticism that he received after the verdict was given. So, and I kind of think that too. He only changed his opinion once everybody was like, hey, you're a piece of shit.
Right. He didn't want to catch no heat.
Yeah.
But he's like, hey, bitch, you know what? No.
So Dominic Dunn kept a journal during the trial, and his journal writings were published in an article in Vanity Fair in the 1984 issue titled "Justice, A Father's Account of the Trial of His Daughter's Killer." Dominic's mother founded Justice for Homicide Victims,
which was a victim's rights group a year after her daughter's death. And so John Sweeney was released on parole in September of 1986 after he had served only 3 years, 7 months, and 27 days of his 6.5 year sentence.
That motherfucker.
Yeah. He got out on good behavior, which is fucking bullshit. So he, about 3 months after his release, he was hired as a head chef of a restaurant, an upscale restaurant in Santa Monica, California called The Chronicle. Dominique's brother,
this is Griffin, where I love her dad.
Dominique's brother, Griffin, her mother and her mother, Lenny, found out where he was working, and they themselves, and they also hired people to come and stand outside of this restaurant where he was making a reported $80,000 a year. And they handed out flyers to the patrons that read, "The food you eat tonight was cooked by the hands that killed Dominique Dunn." Yeah.
Right.
And he eventually...
That's awesome.
...quit his job after this and moved away from this.
Right. He could never... Yeah. That's his punishment in the long run. I think it's hilarious. Everywhere he goes, they're following the snitchy mouth.
Basically. I mean, I do the same thing. So,
me too.
In the mid-1990s, Dominique Dunn was contacted by a Florida doctor who had read his article in Vanity Fair. And the doctor said that his daughter had recently become engaged to a chef named John Sweeney. And he was wondering if it was the same John Sweeney that was responsible for Dominique's death. And he was later identified by a private investigator that it was the same John Sweeney.
Oh, shit.
Her brother, Griffin, called the doctor's daughter and, like, tried to convince her to call off the engagement. I think she eventually did.
I'm glad she did, because she was probably already getting controlled anyway, so I don't know where she's starting from.
Yeah. So he then accused Dominique Dunn of harassing him and said that he was going to change his name so that he couldn't find him. But Dominique Dunn, he didn't stop her. He got another private investigator named Anthony Pelicano to follow and report on his whereabouts and actions. Actually, at this time, Dominic had also approached his private investigator, Anthony Pelicano, about hiring someone to kill Sweeney. He wanted to get a contract out on his life. He had the money to do it. He wanted to do it. But the private investigator, Anthony Pelicano, actually talked him out of doing it.
Right. Like, no, bro, you'll lose everything.
Right.
And he'll get what he wants.
Mm-hmm. So,
if you're dead, who's going to stalk him?
Exactly. So, the private investigator reported that Sweeney had moved to the Pacific Northwest and had changed his name to John Mara, Mara was his mother's name. So, he changed his name from John Sweeney to John Mara. And he continued working as a chef. And then they hired more people to protest and picket the business that hired his daughter's killer. So, yeah.
That's wild, and man.
He went on to work at the Bellage Hotel. And he had stated that he had found God during his short stint in prison, as a lot of people do.
Right, and then get the fuck out of here, guy. We don't care if you found fucking Hitler. We don't care.
Right. We don't care if you found fucking leprechaun.
Right.
So his parole ended in...
How was he able to move all around if he was on parole? He had to have asked for a leave, because when you're on probation, you can't leave the state.
Well, I don't know exactly the when and where, like the dates that he left these places. It should have been after the parole. I don't know. So eventually, Dominic said that he later decided that he no longer wanted to follow Sweeney and squander his life. So he stopped trying to keep tabs on him and went on to become
a true crime writer slash reporter, and he wrote regularly for Vanity Fair, and he based several best-selling novels off of real-life events. And in 2002, he began hosting the TV series Dominic Dunn's Power, Privilege, and Justice on Court TV, which he discussed. He covered a lot of famous trials, including O.J. Simpson, the Menendez.
Oh my God,
O.J. Simpson, the Menendez brothers, and Michael Skakel.
Yeah, fuck Michael Skakel. You know who Michael Skakel is?
Yep,
from Martha Moxley.
Martha Moxley.
We remember, Michael. We remember.
We remember. Yeah. So, and in 2005, he was sued by former California Congressman Gary Condit after he had implicated him in the disappearance of intern Chandra Levy in Washington, D.C. You've heard of Chandra Levy, haven't you?
Yeah, I have.
So, Chandra Levy was from Condit's congressional district, and he had previously admitted to an extramarital affair with her.
Right, and then she went missing.
Mm-hmm. And then was later
found. And her body was found where they was exactly where they searched. Yeah. And she wasn't there that time.
And it's still unsolved to this day. But so he had a Gary Condit had won an undisclosed financial settlement and an apology from Dominic, you know, upon suing him. So right. In September 2008, Dominic disclosed that he was being treated for bladder cancer, and he died on August 26th, 2009. And this was kind of weird.
Damn, man.
But this next part's a little weird. But after his death, his son, Griffin Dunn, had confirmed that his father was bisexual, but had been celibate for 20 years. And he said that his father had kept this central part of his personality to himself until he died.
What in the actual motherfucker?
Being like in the closet your entire life, and then when you die, you're
no,
like,
I couldn't.
Hey, my dad was gay, by the way.
Just to let you know, he was celibate. He never had sex, but he was gay.
Right. So today, at this day and age, John Sweeney still resides in California. Now he lives in San Rafael, California, where he is the director of food services for Smith Ranch Homes, which is a senior retirement community. And I went to their Facebook page, and they do have people that comment on their stuff regularly and say, why did you hire a murderer? Like shit like that.
So, oh shit. Really?
I love it. I am here for that.
So, we should go in there and do that.
I know. So, that's pretty much the story of Dominique, but I kind of wanted to talk for a little second about the poltergeist curse that we talked about earlier. Because there's a few like kind of semi-interesting things that happened.
I think they're just coincidences, but everybody can go with the curse. But
it's still kind of weird though. Some of the stuff that happened.
It is weird.
So, weird. We'll start with obviously Dominique. You know, she was part of this poltergeist curse that people have come up with. And also her co-star, which was the star of the film, Heather O'Rourke. I don't know how to say that.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
The little blonde girl that played Carol Ann. In 1988, she was misdiagnosed with Crohn's disease when, in fact, she had a bowel obstruction that caused septic shock. But unfortunately, the symptoms of the shock were incorrectly attributed to the flu and not immediately treated. And she died at 12 years old as the obstruction released toxins into her bloodstream.
That's crazy.
Right. So another person involved in the film, Richard Lawson, he played Ryan in the original Poltergeist film. And he is now also married to Beyonce's mother. Fun fact. But in 1992, he boarded a flight 405 to Cleveland, and many of the passengers on this flight reported feeling uneasy before the flight lifted off. And Lawson was actually bumped up to first class after a flight attendant recognized him from the movie and was like, "Hey, do you want to move up to first class?" And
So after he moved up into first class, the plane took off. The plane crashed into a bay after a failed takeoff with its passengers trapped in their seat. 27 of those people died, including the person that was in Lawson's original signed seat.
Oh, my God. If he lived its final destination.
If he hadn't been bumped up to first class, it could have been him that died instead.
And then he goes off to marry Beyonce's mom.
Yep.
This guy's right. Lucky as fuck.
I know, right? So another thing that happened, Lou Perryman, who played Pugsley, a construction worker, which it wasn't like a huge, he didn't have like a huge part in the film. But right. In 2009, a man named Seth Christopher Tatum was on the run from police and entered Lou Perryman's home and killed him by attacking him with an axe.
Oh my God, that's fucked up. An axe?
Yeah.
Shit.
So another one, Oliver Robbins, who played the middle child, Robbie, in the film, right. He had a near-death experience on set when he was reportedly attacked by a mechanical clown in a scene that supposed to be struggling with the creepy clown. It malfunctioned and choked him. And because the scene was meant to like show a struggle, the cast members like thought that his reaction was him acting. And it wasn't until he started to turn blue that they intervened and pulled it off of him. So he almost died from that fucking clown attacking him, which is kind of crazy.
That is kind of creepy, dog. That's creepy as fuck.
That's
on some other level shit. Oh my God, that's creepy.
Another person, Will Sampson, who played the Native American shaman in the second Poltergeist film. And he was also, I don't know if you've seen this movie before, but it's a really good movie. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
You're seeing that movie? He plays the big, tall Native American guy that's in that movie.
Okay. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. He had a degenerative condition called scleroderma, which caused him to lose weight rapidly and become malnourished. And his poor health had caused him to need a heart and lung transplant. And it was like a risky thing because of his condition. And he ended up dying after the surgery. Next two aren't deaths, but they're kind of weird. Jo Beth Williams, who played the mother in the films, recalled an odd nervous feeling on set. And she said that she had often returned home from a day's shooting to find all of the pictures in her house tilted. And she would straighten them. And the next day she'd go to work, and then she'd come home,
laughed.
And they were all crooked again. Because there was also
somebody's playing jokes on her.
There was also rumors of, which these rumors had never been confirmed, but a lot of people, and including the people on the cast, said that the skulls that were used in the scene where they're like in the pool with the skulls were actual human skulls.
Oh my God.
I don't know if that's true, but
yeah, I think they just hyped that all up for the movie. Honestly, I think individually each one, besides that fucking weird Beyonce guy.
Well, like, individually, this next one, there's only one more, and this next one's kind of weird, but James Caan, and he wasn't directly involved in the film's production, but he wrote the novel Poltergeist. And he reported that right after writing the line, lightning streaked the sky. A lightning bolt struck the building that he was in.
Yeah, and that's that
all the lights went out. All the lights went out, and the video games in his house turned on and started playing.
Yeah, anytime that you get struck by lightning, it surges power, so that makes sense.
Yeah, but it was
everything
weird.
Would come on afterwards.
Right after he said lightning struck. Lightning.
Yeah, that's coincidental. Like, yeah. You know.
So that's it. That's psychic. All I got. We have a domestic violence hotline number again.
I wanted to talk to them about the cycle of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Real quick. So there are three stages of cycle of abuse of violence. You know, first it's a tension building stage. And then there, the second is the actual exploitation where you're getting physically abused. And then the third is the honeymoon phase where the perpetrator may be sorry or act like nothing happened, but it's still interested in making up and may even promise to never do it again. But almost always, guys, they do it again. So if you find yourself in a cycle like this, it's time to start setting money aside to step out and leave the relationship. See, a lot of people don't understand is that a survivor of domestic abuse does not need to experience physical abuse to be abused. Often, psychological abuse can leave someone feeling fearful, helpless, and powerless to act on their own behalf. People affected by domestic violence are rich, poor, married, divorced, or single, and from all ethnic backgrounds and economic levels. So, ladies, we have to protect ourselves and make sure.
See what happened to Dominique Dunn. She was in a very privileged and wealthy family.
So on the website peaceoverviolence.org, you guys should check it out. It has a power and control wheel, and it tells you, and it like individually, like emotional abuse is putting her down or making her feel bad about herself, calling her names, making her think she's crazy, and mind games. That's emotional abuse. And economical abuse is what me and Haley had discussed before we got on. Is trying to keep her from the money or keep her from getting a job, making her ask for money or giving her an allowance or taking her money. If you feel like that's happening to you, you need to get out. Sexual abuse, making her do sexual things against her will. Just because you guys are together doesn't mean you have to give up the pussy. That is 100% for real. Physically attacking the sexual parts of her body or treating her like a sex object is another one. Using your children, making her feel guilty about the children, using the children to give her messages and using visitation as a way to harass her. If you see this, you need to get out immediately. Threats, making up and carrying out threats to do something to hurt her emotionally, threaten to take her children, commit suicide, or report her welfare. We've all been in situations, well, I can't speak for everybody, but I know people that's been in situations where the guy, when you go to leave, they swear they're going to kill themselves or harm themselves or leave. That's just them trying to pull you back in and make you feel sorry. Using male privilege, treating her like a servant, making all the big decisions and acting like the master of the castle. You guys, it's 2021. Do not let a man treat you like a fucking slave. You are not a slave. You're a strong, independent woman. And this also goes for men, too. I do want to say that if these things are happening in any relationship, it's time to get out. It's domestic violence and isolation, controlling what you do, telling you what to see, what to watch, telling you that, you know, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. It is domestic violence. When your lover calls you a bitch, let me tell you something. It's domestic violence. I'm telling you this because I've been to the classes and I'm telling you from the from my heart. If they're showing you the signs, okay, you need to get out. If they're showing you any of those signs, you need to leave. You may be blind to it. They may be in the stage of love bombing you and you think everything's great. But have you moved quickly? Has it been great and now things are starting to go south? It's only going to get worse from here. And if a man can even push you, mug you, any of those things, it's domestic violence. Please seek shelter. Get help. Look for your local shelters. You can Google. There's a ton of things that you can do if you're trapped in a situation and you can't get out. Look for close to a friend. You may be isolated. You may not have no friends, but you can always figure out a way. And Haley's going to give you a domestic violence hotline number that you can reach just in case if you ever need to find a way out. They'll be able to put you into places that's in your county and your town to help you with that situation.
Yes. And the domestic violence hotline is 1-800-799-7233. And you can also visit thehotline.org. If you are not able to call, you can text and chat with someone that can help you.
Yes, and make sure you go check out the peaceoverviolence.org. It has a lot of explanations of domestic violence. If you're one of those people that need to see, oh my God, is this probably me? If you are asking yourself, is this probably me? Like the guy or woman you're with, or meeting two or so, or one or two of those criteria, it's time to go. Because domestic violence is real. People are dying. Women and children are getting murdered. Men and women are getting murdered. even when the person wants to move on and she gets a new boyfriend. And we've seen situations where they were murdered. We've covered these kind of cases all the time. You would think that it'd be time for us to wake up and realize what the fucking signs are. But it's hard. It's hard to see that. And for somebody that hasn't been through it, they think, well, why the fuck are they dealing with that? Like, why don't you get out of that? It's not as easy as it seems. They trap you in so much that you feel like you can't leave. And then they do crazy shit when you do leave. So it's like, what do? Well, look for help. Go to any website with domestic violence. Call the domestic violence. Reach out to somebody. Get your help and get out.
Heard that.
Right. Domestic violence is... I wish it was like... I think that they need to be harsher laws on people that abuse women or men.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I feel like there should be not just a slap on the wrist. Because, you know, if a woman went off and fucking killed a guy because he, like, ruined her life and just did her dirty for years and years, and she finally snaps and goes kills him, she's going to be in prison for the rest of her life. But if a man... freaks out for a minute, accidentally kills somebody, he can only get 7 years? That's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. It's well, just
not
crazy.
Even, not even 7 years. You know, he got out in 3.5 or 3 years, I think it was.
Yeah, did 3.
Yeah.
So that's crazy to me.
Maybe next week we won't have such a sad case, but I mean, they're all sad, really.
Right, which I think we just always do sad case, right? I think we're just no getting away from it. Sometimes we gotta.
Except next for the week's blue, case, gonna be a really good one. We're like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah, the Bluebell case, we were like, yeah, maybe we can find more cases that are upbeat that they live in.
Yeah.
You know what? We'll go with that when it happens. But next week's case, we're not going to say what it is, but it's going to be a really good one. Really, really good one. We're actually going to meet in person for this
one. Yeah.
That's how yeah. Because finally, Haley got her COVID shot. She's ready to roll out.
I did. I still got to get my second dose, but I'm ready to fucking go everywhere, travel everywhere. So.
Right.
If you haven't gotten a zombie yet, I haven't turned into a zombie yet. So if you haven't gotten your vaccine shot, stay home, motherfuckers.
Right.
And take it easy, killer.
Yeah, she's protected. Easy, killer.